From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So, did it work? Yesterday, President Trump tried to move on from his almost universally condemned press conference with Russia's Vladimir Putin, saying he misspoke when he said, "I don't know why it would be Russia behind the interference of U.S. elections," saying he meant to say, "I don't know why it wouldn't be Russia." But lawmakers in both parties are weighing their options. Let's check in with Rick Klein, political director for ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
So we had leaders like Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, Republicans, condemning the president's performance Monday, in which he sided with Russia's Putin against U.S. agencies. What is Washington saying about what was a rare admission of a misstep yesterday?
Exceedingly rare, and I think it scrambled some of the traditional politics, but also gotten people back into some typical grooves. There were a lot of Republicans who were very skeptical on Monday. They hear what was said on Tuesday, and now on Wednesday they're saying, okay, I'm satisfied that the president is in the right place. But let me tell you, he did not fully walk back that statement, and I think that is a part that is sticking in the minds of even a lot of Republicans. They're willing to cut the president some benefit of the doubt here, but they are still very skeptical about the overall tone and tenor and the fact that even in seeming to walk back that initial statement, he did say, well, it could have been other people hacking us in addition to the Russians.
He walked back his walk back. And he's tweeting out today defiantly that in the long run, his meeting will be seen as a great success and saying his critics are suffering from Trump derangement syndrome. This is a phrase we are starting to hear. Andrew Bacevich, the military analyst, writes about it today. A danger for Democrats, he says, that this is how Trump supporters are characterizing what they say is almost an hysterical, paranoid reaction to Trump. Trump derangement syndrome.
Yeah, and I think it's not actually an actual medical diagnosis, but there is an episode after episode that it seems to play out the same way, where the president will do or say something that is controversial, and his opponents take it too far. Now, is this one of those? I think there's a lot of outrage to go around in what he said about Russia, and I think it was bipartisan outrage. But it is a playing according to what we've seen many other times. And I think when the president says something, he goes out and there's kind of a half step of an apology and then defiance, and it's almost daring his opponents to dig in some more and to continue attack, attack, attack. We're already seeing more Democrats calling for impeachment, some of them calling this an episode of treason. All of those things, I do think, play in some way into the president's hands. He knows where his base is, and I think he may have done enough already to just mollify the critics inside of his own party to let it try to pass.
Well, but even House Speaker Paul Ryan said he might be open to more sanctions on Russia. But what about, you know, the fact that others are saying, wait, we don't even know we saw the press conference. We don't know what happened in the meeting. And they met for the two leaders met for 2 hours with only interpreters present. People like Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire want to bring the president's interpreters before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And it's interesting. We're talking a lot about language this week on the program. But is that likely to happen?
No, I think it's a gimmick on the part of Democrats to call for that. But it gets at a serious point, which is that no one really knows what transpired between the two leaders. I talked to a key Republican senator who's on the Homeland Security Committee. It was very critical of the president just on Monday. He now says, though, the president's entitled to have private conversations with a foreign leader, and that really isn't Congress's business. So I feel like the Republicans are mostly falling back into the sort of line that you'd expect here. I think there's still a lot of questions that were raised by Monday. I don't think we're going to see the interpreter out there, but I do think a lot of people have very valid questions about what the actual message that transpired between Trump and Putin. We'll probably never know.
Well, this morning, Trump tweeted that Russia has agreed to help with North Korea. Yesterday, a Russian military official said they were ready for practical implementation of the agreements reached between Russian President Vladimir Putin and U.S. President Donald Trump in the sphere of international security achieved at the Helsinki summit. I mean, there's sort of a wait and see, of course, what that really means. But in that instance, it looks as if the president can say, see, in befriending President Putin, I have helped with North Korea.
Yeah, I think they may have been searching for something as a takeaway from here more than anything else. I'm not clear that there was actually something achieved out of this summit along those lines. But the broader argument that the president puts forward and a lot of his allies is, look, you can't argue that Russia isn't important. It is geostrategically, geopolitically critical to any discussion around national security and foreign policy. And so having that conversation, having the dialogue, moving the ball forward is a good thing. Question of meddling is almost a separate one in their minds. And the president doing his best to kind of straddle that and to keep it in the realm of the political.
ABC News political director Rick Klein, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And now to a story that has nothing to do with President Trump. There is a sector of the prison population that's being kept behind bars after their release date. That's according to a new analysis by member station WBEZ in Chicago, which found that prison parolees with disabilities end up staying in jail because there are few places equipped to accept them. Take John Ellis. He was sent to prison for 2 years for theft.
The first thing you start doing is planning for when you get out, what you're going to do, what steps you're going to take.
But when his release date came, Ellis had nowhere to go. WBEZ's Shannon Heffernan has our story.
Ellis gave away his long underwear. He didn't expect to spend another winter in prison at Graham Correctional Center. He packed his stuff, tucking away important papers like prescriptions. He was ready to walk out the gate.
When that day came, nothing happened. They didn't even tell me anything. And I was kind of flipping out, you know, like, what's going on here, you know?
The next morning, Ellis says he went to a place in prison he calls the bubble, where guards sat. They had a microphone and would announce information.
I'm there every day at, 8 o'clock in the morning, ready for them to call my name. Hey, it's time for you to go.
Wow, every morning you're showing up there thinking maybe today.
Yeah, for at least the first couple of weeks.
Eventually, someone from the prison staff came to tell John Ellis why they hadn't let him out yet. It had to do with his disability. He has major depressive disorder. In Illinois, most prisoners have a period of mandatory supervised release after prison. It's like parole. You live out in the community, but check in with a parole officer. That's what Ellis was supposed to be on. It requires that you have stable housing where parole officers can find you. Ellis had been planning to stay at a halfway house. The state sometimes pays for these places so people can have time to get on their feet. But Ellis says a prison officer told him that wasn't going to be an option.
She said, well, we contacted the halfway offices and they denied you placement. I said, well, what for? And she said, for mental health issues.
With no housing, they couldn't let him out of prison, saying he was in violation of his supervised release before he even left prison doors. Because of that, he was locked up a year longer than his sentence required.
It just doesn't make no sense to me.
What did you feel like hearing that news?
It blew my mind. I mean, I did my 2 years what I was supposed to do for the crime I committed. Here I am stuck for another year for nothing.
Despite months of requests, officials at the Illinois Department of Corrections would not agree to an interview for this story. But in a written statement, they said if given the budget by lawmakers, they would like to provide more housing. Without more information, it's hard to know exactly how often a disability keeps someone from leaving prison on time. But we do know that in 2017, 152 people were in prison past their release date. That number excludes sex offenders because they have trouble finding housing for a set of different reasons. The corrections department doesn't know how many of those 152 inmates had disabilities. But Amanda Antholt says she regularly hears from wheelchair users or people with psychiatric disabilities who can't get out of prison on the day they're supposed to. She's a disability rights lawyer with Equip for Equality.
People with disabilities cannot get access halfway houses, and that means they are discriminated against because of their disability. And as a result of that discrimination, they are spending more time in prison than they should.
WBEZ obtained an official IDOC housing directory from corrections officials, presumably a list of places where they send people leaving prison for housing. We called all 75 places on the list. Most said they would not take someone coming straight from prison with a psychiatric disability or someone who is deaf or blind. Only 13 of those 75 places said they were equipped to house someone coming straight from prison who used a wheelchair. One of those places said they only had a single wheelchair-accessible bed. Another said it had waiting lists for disability slots that were months long. Antolt says if people with disabilities don't have equal access to parole or supervised release, that could violate the Americans with Disabilities Act.
When they have served enough time under our sentencing laws, they should get released. It's not good for our overcrowded prison system and the amount of money that our state has to pay to keep them incarcerated. It's better if we get people out and back to their communities as soon as they are eligible to go back.
Parole and supervised release aren't supposed to only be about punishment. They are tools that are supposed to help inmates transition to life beyond prison, That's not what it did for John Ellis, who couldn't get housing because of his psychiatric disability. He spent all of his supervised release time behind bars. When he got out, he went straight into homelessness. It's been rough. A friend let him keep prescription papers in a van since there was nowhere else safe. But that friend left town, so Ellis wasn't able to get his prescriptions filled. We talked to Ellis outside a friend's house where he'd crashed for the night. He says he's been bouncing around.
Sometimes you got to stay places you don't want to stay. You know, but you just be indoors, you do.
And you don't want to stay there, why?
Because of some activities that could be going on there or whatever.
What do you think's going to happen next for you?
I don't know. It's a toss-up. I mean, you know, I think something's got to give. Something's got to change. I know that. You know, I can't. I'm going the wrong direction already.
Ellis says he would have preferred to stay at a halfway house. He doesn't like staying at these friends' places. It feels risky and unstable. But at least they'll take him. For Here and Now, I'm Shannon Heffernan in Chicago.
This week we've been talking about language for our series Speaking My Language. We've talked about the language education gap in the United States, and yesterday we spoke to a couple of polyglots who've learned many different languages as a hobby.
It's more wanting to discover more of the world. I learned Russian, I learned Korean. It's just what I like to do. It's connecting with these different cultures.
Today, we'll hear from someone who's made a living off of fluency in different languages. Lynn Visson is a teacher and writer and was an interpreter at the United Nations for 22 years, interpreting French and Russian into English. Lynn, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for inviting me.
And by the way, we called you an interpreter there as opposed to a translator. Explain what the difference is.
The difference, and a lot of people confuse this, even some interpreters and translators, is that with a translator, you give the person a written text in one language, and the person will give you back a written text in another language. With an interpreter, you will speak to the person in one language, and the person will orally interpret that and speak in the other language. It's the difference between written and oral.
And is it much more difficult to do it as it's happening, as opposed to waiting for the person to finish their sentence or their comment and then interpreting it?
Well, what you're asking about is the difference between what we call simultaneous interpretation, where you interpret right away or as quickly as you can. The usual gap for simultaneous interpretation is approximately 6 seconds. Huh. Anything longer than that, somebody will notice.
So is it harder to do simultaneous translation than to wait until the person is finished? In other words, if a politician is making a statement, do you wait until they're done with the statement and then interpret what they've said, or are you interpreting as they're speaking?
No, you're usually going as they're speaking, and you're hoping that your speaker will pause and pause long enough to give you a chance to interpret. Hmm. Most experienced politicians and speakers who've worked with interpreters know that they have to stop at the end of a sentence or a clause to give the interpreter time to interpret.
That must be pretty hard.
It is. You get used to it.
Mm-hmm. What skills do you think you have to have to be a good interpreter?
You have to have speed. You have to be able to listen, immediately grasp what someone is saying, and put it into another language, and put it into grammatical sentences and full sentences. One of the worst things an interpreter can do is not finish a sentence.
So who are some of the most notable people that you've ever had to interpret?
Well, I've done quite a few, not necessarily at the UN, some of them outside the UN. I interpreted for Boris Yeltsin when he was the president of Russia. He was quite easy because he spoke very slowly. I interpreted for Jimmy Carter when he was receiving a Russian Baptist minister, and Carter was quite easy to do because he had very good diction and spoke very clearly. And then there are all kinds of UN delegates. Some of them go like bats out of hell at 100 miles an hour. Hmm. And others realize that the interpreter needs time and they slow down.
And when you are interpreting for somebody like that, somebody high profile, do you have to worry about how you are interpreting, how you're presenting their thoughts to the other party?
Well, you want to be sure that you're speaking in grammatical sentences, that you're using proper intonation. It is very difficult to listen to a monotone when somebody is not varying the sound of their voice and things are monotonous because eventually you'll lose your audience.
Right.
And one thing, when you train interpreters, you train them in the use of intonation and intonation in the language into which they're interpreting, not from which they're working.
Is there ever a moment when the politician says something that might be offensive to the other and you want to soften it a little before you interpret?
That happens, but that's not your job.
Uh-huh.
Your job is to interpret what is actually being said, even though it may be very unpleasant, or it may be something that you personally find repulsive or disagree with. It's a bit like acting. I mean, mm-hmm. there are plenty of great actors who act murderers, even though they'd never in their lives kill anybody.
You've got to make sure that you know how to say, "Don't blame the messenger" in Russian.
Exactly.
So did you grow up speaking both French and Russian?
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Because my parents were Russian emigres. Their parents had left Russia during the revolution with their families. And after they bounced around Europe for a while, because like so many other people, they thought these were minor political disturbances that would soon blow over, but didn't. They wound up in France, where they stayed for 20 years. They got married in Paris. And my father was in the French army during the war. Then they came to America in 1941, to New York, where I was born.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's more difficult to interpret from Russian to English or from French to English?
I don't really think one can make a comparison. If you're raised with the languages, it doesn't matter. If you're a native speaker of English who doesn't know either, it's probably more difficult from Russian because the structure of Russian is so much different from the structure of English.
Did you notice a difference in the Russian language after the Soviet Union broke up?
Oh, yes, tremendously, tremendously. Before the Soviet Union broke up, you could interpret or translate with a fairly limited vocabulary of clichés. And a lot of people did exactly that. And once the Soviet Union broke up, the language style changed completely. All kinds of colloquial words came into the language. Hmm. Words that people would not ordinarily use in conversation became common. The whole style of the language changed overnight almost.
Like what? I mean, I don't speak Russian, but just speak in a little bit of Russian. Show me what you're talking about.
Well, okay, that's all right. Fine. Let's do this. Keep going. Things like that.
Mm-hmm. And how would you say those things in Russian?
Ну давай, пойдем, сделаем. Mm-hmm. It would depend on the context.
Okay. Were there ever times as an interpreter when you were stumped by an expression or an accent or a confusing speaker or a joke that just didn't translate?
I think every interpreter I know, every professional, has at some point been stumped. And anyone who tells you they haven't been is not telling you the truth. What you learn is how to cope with it.
There are also probably moments when the conversation that you're having to interpret is talking about things that aren't talked about all the time. Like maybe there's, you know, a topic like energy or fisheries that you're going to have to interpret. Do you have to study up on those before you do that?
Yes. I mean, at the UN, if you knew pretty much what meeting you would be in the next day, and very often you could get the documents for the meeting in advance. And if it was technical, that was very helpful. Your examples are very good. For example, fisheries. Nobody tends to know in three languages the names of 15 different kinds of fish. So you would study up on that and look on that and prepare for it. For the regular political social language, that is pretty much the same, and there you get very used to it.
There's also probably a lot of UN jargon that you have to know.
Oh, absolutely. It's called UNese.
Give me an example of it.
Mr. Chairman, on behalf of my delegation, I wish to assure you of our total and complete support for the proposal which has just been made by the majority of delegations present, comma, including those of the Third World.
I feel okay? Like you've had to say that a few times.
So do I.
Yeah. So let's talk about language in general. Do you find that you think differently in Russian or French than you do in English?
Yes, I think so, in part because of the syntax. In Russian, syntax and word order are quite different from English. Very often you have a verb toward the end of the sentence, and you can usually tell when somebody is not a native speaker of the language by their syntax, by the word order of their sentences.
Mm-hmm. I was speaking to a friend who is from Mexico and is bilingual, and another friend of hers who is also from Mexico had moved to the United States when she was about 13. So that was the last time that she was living in a Spanish-speaking country. Mm-hmm. And my friend said that her friend sounded like a teenager when she spoke in Spanish, because that was the, that was the point at which she stopped, you know, learning it.
That's that can be a problem for children raised by parents speaking a foreign language, which is that at some point, unless they study the language, unless they really delve into it, unless they're interested in it, their knowledge of the language will stop at the age of a 12 or 13-year-old as they move into upper grades of high school or college where they're thinking and writing primarily in English.
So overall, you know, we're talking all week about foreign language on the show. What are your thoughts mm-hmm. on the benefits of speaking more than one language, which is something that, frankly, the majority of Americans don't do?
I agree with you completely. It's something the majority of Americans, I would add, unfortunately, don't do. Mm-hmm. I wish there were more of it. I think there is far too little emphasis now on the learning of foreign languages. It's very useful both in terms of thinking and learning the structure of other languages, and of course for travel and for getting to know people and for literature. Reading a translation is not the same thing as reading a book mm-hmm. in the original.
What language would you like to learn still?
Well, at the UN, where I worked for 22 years, there were free language courses for any UN staff members, any of the six official UN languages. So I took Spanish, mm-hmm. I took Chinese, and I took a little Arabic, and that was great fun. And if I had the chance, I'd love to go back to Chinese because I didn't have the time to keep up with it, and I really enjoyed those courses, and they were very well taught.
That's Lynn Visson, who is a teacher, writer, and a former UN interpreter. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Wild Boars soccer team and their coach were finally released from the hospital today in Chiang Rai, Thailand. The boys gave their first public comment since their rescue from that cave complex that captured the world's attention. They were in that cave for weeks. Joining us now from Chiang Rai is the BBC's Howard Johnson. Howard, it was pretty amazing to see these kids looking healthy at this press conference.
Yeah, it was an amazing experience to see the boys finally emerge into the media spotlight for the first time. I've been covering the story for more than 3 weeks. And when they walked into the room, there was a rapturous applause. They came in with their football kits. They sat down and began talking. The mood was one of joyousness. It was happy. There were lots of jokes and laughter. Early on, one of the Thai Navy SEAL divers joked that he was the most handsome in the cave, and all the boys erupted into laughter. Mm. And that set the tone for this conversation. We heard from others talking about how they had dug down into the cave to try to find a way out. Maybe childish exuberance there. But we also heard that the boys had used water dripping from the ceiling to survive this ordeal. There were some details about how they got to the shelf that gave them respite in the end, that was 400 meters beyond Pattaya Beach. They said that there was a section where the boys had to swim a little bit, even though some of the boys aren't very good swimmers. Most of all, this was a joyous experience. Lots of people laughing. There were a few moments when they reflected on the death of Saman Gunan, the former Thai Navy SEAL diver who tragically died trying to save the boys. The room became a little bit somber, but they were willed on by their friends, their family. There were nurses on the sidelines being supportive. A psychiatrist was on stage to help the children as well. And all in all, when they left, they received gifts from the Thai king, and the crowd erupted into cheers and applause as they left the building.
What about the coach who was in there with them? What did he say? A lot of people have credited him with keeping the boys calm.
Coach Ek confirmed that he used his skills that he picked up in a monastery when he was training to be a monk to help the boys to get through this ordeal. He spoke of teaching them meditation to conserve their energy, something we'd heard a lot before. He also said that he prayed to Buddha. He was hoping that on the first night the water levels would drop and they'd be able to find their way out, but that obviously didn't happen. Then he started to hope that officials would come looking for the children. He also apologized to the family of Saman Gunan, the former Thai Navy SEAL diver who died tragically in this operation.
We had heard that the boys had been sedated to some degree when they were taken out of the cave, so they would be calm as they did that. Did they remember what it was like to come out of the cave?
That's the one detail that wasn't picked up on during this press conference. We heard a little bit about Dr. Richard Harris, the doctor, the Australian doctor and diver who helped with this operation. There was no talk of any sedatives being used or anything to calm the boys, but we did hear that Dr. Richard Harris had suggested that any of the boys could leave first. It wasn't a case of the weakest or the strongest leaving first. He said that it was up to Coach Eck to decide which of the boys would leave first. And then what happened was they were asked to put up their hands, the first four who wanted to leave. So it was purely based on who wanted to leave the cave first, who actually left the cave first.
What a great ending to just an unbelievable story. That's Howard Johnson of the BBC in Chiang Rai, Thailand. Howard, thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's almost time to get your ABBA on, the follow-up to Mamma Mia, the 2008 film based on the Swedish group's music, opens in theaters this week. It's called Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. So everyone, throw up your arms, look up at aerial cameras, and run through the streets of Greece singing.
Mamma Mia, here I go again. My, my, how can I resist ya? Mamma Mia, does it show again? My, my, just how much I missed ya.
Everybody, if you haven't seen it or the hit stage show before it, Mamma Mia tells the story of Sophie, who searches her mother's diary to find the three men who might be her dad, inviting them to her wedding at her mother's rundown hotel in Greece without telling her mother, Donna, a former rock and roller. Hey, it could happen. It was a summer smash 10 years ago, and now the entire cast, plus some notable additions, has returned for the combination prequel sequel. And yes, you will see Meryl Streep, though we can say no more. Mamma Mia productions have grossed some $2 billion since the musical first premiered in London in 1999. Producer Judy Kramer has done pretty well as well. She'd never produced anything when she came up with the idea of Mamma Mia. Now she's got the new Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, and she joins us from the BBC studios in London. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
How did you come up with this idea? Was it really you listening to The Winner Takes It All?
It really was me listening to The Winner Takes It All. I had the pleasure and honor to meet Benny Andersson and Björn Ulvaeus in the 80s.
Two members of ABBA.
The two members of ABBA, the actual composers of ABBA. Mm-hmm. And I was working for Tim Rice, the lyricist, who wrote Jesus Christ Superstar, and he was writing a musical with them called Chess in the 80s. And my first job was to go and pick them up from the airport. So that's how I met them. And many years later, I now have a company with them, and we own Mamma Mia together.
Well, talk about The Winner Takes It All. We're going to listen to a little of it. There's something so unbelievably corny and so unbelievably majestic about this song. What were you? What happened to you when you heard it?
I just love Winner Takes It All. It's the roller coaster breakup song. I think it's a kind of conversation. In fact, I probably thought it was the song I wanted to sing to any of the boyfriends that I'd had in my life at that time. And I think it is a strong woman's song, and that's what fascinated me. But what was the story behind that song? And that really was the inspiration and the jump-off point.
I played all my cards, and that's what you've done too. Nothing more to say, no more ace to play. The winner takes it all, the loser standing small beside the victory.
By the way, was this about ABBA breaking up? Because they did.
They did. I mean, ABBA were, you know, famously all married to each other. And I think also when I started wanting to create something out of ABBA songs, that ABBA songs fell into two camps. There were the younger ABBA songs that they wrote in the earlier days of ABBA. The more emotional songs like Winner Takes It All and My Love, My Life, and Knowing Me, Knowing You, that was probably as they were going through their own personal breakups.
So a lot of emotion there. So you approach Benny and Bjorn, who you know. They do give you permission to roll with this, see what you can do. Do you understand originally you had to, I think you sold an apartment to finance this and to try to buy more time?
Yes. I mean, I was a working producer. I had this passion to make this work. You know, you have to have money, the seed money, to pay for a script or to pay for an airfare. And so I sold my flat and I actually gave up the day job, really, so I could concentrate on this. So it was a huge investment of time and passion. And then Bjorn and Benny allowed me to use their songs. But there was always a sword of Damocles hanging over my head that if it all went wrong, they could take them back.
Yeah. But instead, a huge success. Stage productions around the world, 16 languages. Let's listen to a little of the Mandarin production from 2011. It's in Shanghai. And then the movie. You must not have been able to believe your lucky stars. You get Meryl Streep as Donna. And here's a little of her performing The Winner Takes It All.
The gods may throw the dice, their minds as cold as ice, and someone way down here loses someone dear. The winner takes it all, the loser has to fall. It's simple and it's plain.
So, huge success, but how scary to have the second movie. You go deeper into the ABBA catalog, and you have to, I mean, there's an expectation that it will be the same experience, you know, the first film brought so many people. How hard was that?
Well, the stakes were high to do another film. Probably that's the reason it's been 10 years, and I think if we'd done one, you know, a few years after the first film, that people would have seen it as a more cynical enterprise, and organically it worked to wait this long, but also it was a matter of finding the right story and the right premise to take us into the new film, and of course how to bring our wonderful original cast back.
Yes, and we will not, you know, again, say no more. But you have an equally inspired choice, equal to that of Meryl Streep in this film, which is Cher, who plays Donna's mother, Meryl Streep's mother. Let's listen to a little of Cher performing the ABBA hit Fernando.
Can you hear the drums, Fernando? I remember long ago another starry night like this. In the firelight, Fernando, you were humming to yourself and softly strumming your guitar. I could hear the distant drums and sounds of bugle calls were coming from afar.
Just talk about that, what Cher brings to this.
Well, I think, you know, two of my biggest career excitements is, you know, to have cast Meryl Streep in the first film, but to have Meryl Streep and Cher in this film, because all of this new movie goes back to the origins of the backstory of the stage show and the last film. And Donna Sheridan, the character played by Meryl Streep, mentions a couple of times her mother. Mm. So who was that going to be? We thought the kind of ultimate rock chick supremo, and quite a kind of complex character, the mother character. And I think that appealed to Cher very much. She liked the whole kind of mother, grandmother, very strong kind of woman, not particularly conventional, which, of course, I think Cher is really in many aspects. And that song, well, you know, I feel it was written for her. I mean, it's spine tingling.
Yeah. But do you ever get sick of them? Do you ever get sick of Mamma Mia? Here We Go Again.
No, I never tire of those songs. I mean, I think there's something that compels you. You put Dancing Queen on and you just want to dance. I mean, you know, it's the, well, everyone says a guilty pleasure, but I just think there's an alchemy in those songs.
Well, we always are looking for an excuse to put it on, so we will. Judy Kramer, thank you, and congratulations again.
Thank you very much. I hope everyone enjoys it.
Producer Judy Kramer, the woman you can credit or blame for the whole Mamma Mia concept. Go ahead. She's done quite well. She doesn't care. Her new sequel, prequel, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, starts in theaters tomorrow. Okay, everybody.
The midterm elections are now less than 4 months away, and one thing we already know is that there will be a lot of new names on the ballot, including more women and minorities than in past elections. About 100 Muslims around the country have filed to run for office this year, according to Engage USA, a Muslim civil rights group. Saima Farooqi is one of them. She's running for a seat in the State House of Representatives in Florida, and she'd be the first Muslim in the State House if she wins. She joins us from Miami. Saima, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And first of all, just tell us why you wanted to run for office in your district.
I'm running for office because I felt a dire need to help the community. I have lived, worked, and raised my kids in this district for 13 years. And I have felt that the community's opinion and voice hadn't been represented well enough in Florida state's politics.
And you would be the first Muslim in the State House if you win.
When I win, I will be the first Muslim in the State House. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And what does that mean to you?
It means a lot because I'm not just running for a specific community. I'm running for everyone who lives in the district, and I would be the voice for all the minorities and the communities that have been ignored and not well represented for a very long time.
And I know that one of the things that spurred you to run was some of what we've been hearing from President Trump. I just want to take a listen here to him before he was president, speaking in 2015, right after the San Bernardino shooting.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
How did you react when you heard that?
I was very devastated, very depressed with this statement. And I was very concerned that a candidate who's running for the highest office in the country, that kind of statement coming from him, and that is a part of his campaign, that just made me so concerned. And I would like to give a credit to our president that he has kind of ignite the minorities to be together and stand with each other to make a difference. So I think the impact of that statement kind of like gone reverse, that people came out as more united with the sense of togetherness to help each other.
But at the same time, another impact of that statement was that he did follow through and he was able to get his ban on people from majority Muslim countries in place.
That's correct. And that ban is unconstitutional. You cannot ban specific group of people to coming to United States based of their religion and based of their origin. America is the land of opportunity and it's a melting pot. It's land of immigrants. So I don't understand how could he even initiate that kind of ban.
There's also been a lot of sentiment against Muslims holding office in the U.S. I want to listen to a little bit of it. Here's former presidential candidate, now Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Ben Carson, speaking in 2015.
I would not advocate that we put a Muslim in charge of this nation. I absolutely would not agree with that.
And here's a former spokesman for Roy Moore, who ran for Senate in Alabama, speaking in December last year, explaining Moore's belief as to why Muslims shouldn't be in Congress.
You have to swear on a Bible to be an elected official in the United States of America. He alleges that a Muslim cannot do that ethically, swearing on the Bible.
Have you heard that kind of stuff from anybody as you've been campaigning in Florida?
Yes, I did when I was canvassing and trying to get my petition signed. I got some interactions where people, when they saw me at their doors, they were a little biased, and there were they showed their emotions and the hate towards Muslim community, but that really did not hold me back because I got more support than that kind of interactions.
Were there ever days when you felt like you wanted to give up this race?
Never.
Never.
Because those sentiments or statements of hate, that they are kind of like fume and fuel for me. They really ignite me to do even more and strive more. So I really thank those people. They really try to pull me back, but they really give me more motivation to do it because I know we are better than this.
What do you want to accomplish if you end up in office?
I want to represent each and everyone, regardless what they believe, what who they love, where they came from. I wanted to be a voice of everyone, and I want to do the right thing. Within my career, I have gained an experience of problem solving, so I would be I'll be finding solutions to any problem that come across.
That's Saima Farooqui, who is running for a seat in the Florida State House. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And by the way, Saima said that the Trump travel ban was unconstitutional. That is her opinion. The Supreme Court ruled last month that it was constitutional. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.